If you see the whole sequence, it's easier to put into perspective the different components of it. And it's often, the spiritual process is often called a journey. And in the sense that there is time and there's somebody going somewhere, it is a journey. And the journey we've spoken of thus far is one takes a birth, an incarnation, a human birth, and one becomes somebody separate, and then somewhere along the line one awakens to the fact that in addition to being somebody separate, one is also part of everything. And once you awaken to that, albeit for a second or a moment, because of the power of that quality of your being that you touch at that moment, and you touch it in as many ways as we described today and many more, the next part of that journey is the desire to cultivate that quality, that part of your being, that unity, come back into it, to return to the one. And in fact, almost all spiritual practices are designed for that purpose, for someone who was separate to reawaken to their connection to God, or to the oneness, or to the that which is beyond form, back into the formless. All the religious traditions, all the spiritual practices, they're all for that particular aspect. And it's not hard to understand how you can get into what you'd call a renunciate mode at that stage. That is, you've been busy in the world being somebody, and you begin to awaken to the fact that behind all of the multiplicity there is one, and you're part of it. And in your zeal to regain that or come back into that one, you tend to push against where you have been stuck for so long. You begin to see it as a prison, and you tend to denigrate it, and you put it down, and you go into a renunciate mode. And there is a tremendously large tradition of renunciation, spiritual renunciation, that says if you want to cultivate that inner place, that connection to the universal being, to the laws of the universe, to the oneness, to God, to the Spirit, what is required is to remove yourself from the marketplace of desires and of stuff that keeps catching you in your separateness so that you can cultivate that inner quiet being. And so for a long time, there is the stage that one goes through. I don't know how long it is. It depends on the individual. There's a period where one is pushing away the world in order to be transcended, in order to die again, or to die to the world, to be reborn into the Spirit. It's what the twice-bornness is all about. You're going to die first. So there's a dying, and there's a pushing away that which you have been living with. And this is the stage of what's called getting high. Getting high, getting out there, getting out beyond form, transforming oneself. And many of us, in one way or another, have looked for ways to get high, to come back into that place, to awaken again, to, because it tasted so good to be in it. And you know that's your true home, and so you keep pushing away things that keep you from it. People say, I hate the city, it brings me down. I like to be in the country. Gets me high. And you start to develop a world of this brings me down, that gets me out. Being with these people gets me out, being with those people brings me down. Politics brings me down, but singing brings me up. Denver brings me down, but Boulder brings me, you know. I mean, you go through a whole lot of trips. It's just trip after trip after trip of this brings me down, this brings, and you develop the world into a dichotomy or a trichotomy, that which brings you up, that which brings you down, and that which is irrelevant. Doesn't do either. None of that is being free. And you end up in this kind of weird thing that I've likened to that you know, the story about trying to fit yourself into a suit that doesn't fit. You end up saying, if I stand this way, I'll be high. See? And you get all weird behind it. It's called phony holy. You get so you really, really, you know, you smile a lot. Okay? Inside, you're a seething mass of neurosis, but you're smiling a lot because holy people smile. And you get this, all these horrible affectations to try to create a certain thing and push away something else. Can't be depressed. I'm a spiritual person. You know, things like that. And then at some point in the journey, which we're just using the metaphor of journey now, at some point in the journey you realize that getting high is not being free. In fact, as long as you're pushing anything away, it's got you. Like, I can be with God as long as you're not around, you know? Okay. And at that point is the next stage of the journey, where you turn around and you look at what brings you down. And you start to eat it for lunch. You start to turn to the things that catch you, because at that point, up until then, you've just wanted to get high. You've gone wherever it feels good. But then the fact that you are still chained to your mind somewhere or other makes you go the next step, and it makes you want to address the things that are catching you in order to loosen the hold of the way they're catching you. So you make a 180-degree turn, and instead of going towards that which gets you free, you end up going towards that which catches you.
This is called trying to find the right quote.
I'm not trying. It's just it's emerging slowly.
Uh-huh. Soon it'll be emerging.
Emerging. It's not going to emerge. How do you like that?
Mm.
I'll tell you what it's about. I have it. I just don't know where it is. And I wouldn't try even for you.
Mm-hmm.
I could read you another one and phony it, but that would be trying. It's a great one. He knows which one it is, so. It's about going into the water and going into the fire.
Mm.
It's a poem.
You actually, in your orange little booklet, there's a...
section.
There's a section of it.
You want me to read it?
Yeah.
This is again the words of Rumi.
He's going to read the whole thing to you.
It's called The Question. One dervish said to another, "What was your vision of God's presence?" "I haven't seen anything. But for the sake of conversation, I'll tell you a story. God's presence is there in front of me, a fire on the left, a lovely stream on the right. One group walks towards the fire, into the fire, another toward the sweet flowing water. No one knows which are blessed and which not. Whoever walks into fire appears suddenly in the stream. A head goes under on the water surface. That head pokes out of the fire. Most people guard against going into the fire. Most people guard against going into the fire, and so end up in it." Those who love the water of pleasure and make it their devotion are cheated with this reversal. The trickery goes further. The voice of the fire tells the truth, saying, I am not fire, I am fountainhead. Come into me and don't mind the sparks. If you are a friend of God, fire is your water. You should wish to have 100,000 sets of moth wings so you could burn them away one set a night. The moth sees light and goes into fire. You should see fire and go toward light. Fire is what of God is world-consuming, water world-protecting. Somehow each gives the appearance of the other. To these eyes you have now, what looks like water burns. What looks like fire is a great relief to be inside. The fire and the water themselves, accidental, done with mirrors.
See, at that stage where you turn around and you go into the fire instead of into the water, you go towards the things that catch you because it brings you closer to freedom to work with them and to get done with them. Until finally, everything is water, everything is fire. It's all come together. So this is the stage. Stage born, stage becoming separate, stage awakening, stage trying to stay in these other planes of consciousness, renunciation part. Then stage seeing you're not free, turning, starting to look at what it is that catches you still, coming towards the fire of the stuff that catches you, going into it, working with it until it's all the water of delight, it's all joy, it's all play, even the sadness, even the suffering. Then you start to taste of freedom. And then when you're free, you be what you be. Then you enjoy how beautifully the grass is cut. Okay? Because you're not stuck in it. This, in a way, this is the shortest description of a whole spiritual journey. And when you're free, you're not busy being an incarnate, and you're not an incarnate. You are, as Christ said, in the world, but not of the world. You're everything and nothing. You are form and you're formless. We cheat ourselves because we only define ourselves partially. We only notice what's in form. Because we so rely on our eyes and our ears and our nose and our tongue and our skin and our thinking mind to define what's real. And all these things respond to things. So the part of you that is no thing, you never notice. Because you can only be that, you can't know it. And yet that's the essence of the way you're unified with all things. So the sequence, born out of one into the many, awakening out of the many, back into the one, then finding the balance where you are one and you're the many, where you don't put down your incarnation and you don't forget that you're the one. And then it is God at play with itself. It's the one at play with itself. And you never, as Dalai Lama said, you never meet somebody you don't already know. Because there's only one of us and we're all here. About all we've covered this morning, questions, observations, reactions, anything you'd like to share? Yes?
Couldn't that get kind of masochistic if you go towards, say there's somebody that you don't like and you don't want to work with, and would you purposely go for working with that person?
She said, isn't that going, when you go towards somebody you don't like to work with them, isn't that kind of masochistic? See, masochistic is a psychodynamic definition of a statement of an action. And you can, what you do, it's masochistic if you can't convert it. If you can convert it, it's not. It's grace. And you got to know which ones you can do.
So like, if you can't do it,
If you can't, go do something else for a few lifetimes and come back to that person later.
The beautiful thing about the fire is if you walk in out of your ego, I should get it together with this person, you're going to get spit out.
You're going to get burned.
You're going to get burned, yeah.
You get crisped. It crisps egos.
You say, well, I'm not ready to do that.
See,
yeah.
The fire is a fire to crisp egos, you know. It's like I've kidded a lot about in the last administration, I had a lot of trouble with Caspar Weinberger, who was a... There was something about him. He was wrong. He was not a bad human being, but he was just terribly wrong. He was our Secretary of Defense, some of you may remember. And so at the point where I was getting very politically involved and all, I was having trouble. I'd see Casper on television, I'd get infuriated. So I took Casper's picture and I put it on my holy table. And then there was Buddha and Christ and my guru and Ananda Maima and Mary and Caspar Weinberger. And in the morning, I'd light my candles and incense and good morning, Buddha, good morning, Christ, good, oh, Maharaji, oh, ma. Hello, Caspar. And I would see how far I had yet to go before I could see behind the veil of Casperness to find that this was just my guru in drag saying, I bet I'll get you this time. See? So there are certain costumes that God wears that are too much for you to cut through at the moment. That's all you're saying. And if you just beat yourself with it and keep burning, that's what's called masochistic. If, on the other hand, you just say, all right, I'll go do something else and come back to it another time, when I'm stronger in seeing through the veil, then there won't be any masochism.
Any of you remember Casper the Friendly Ghost, that cartoon? That's a great cartoon.
He's turned into that. Questions, observations? Yes.
What can I do about needing to have an image of God in my mind as opposed to the oneness or all that is?
What can I do, she asks, about needing to have an image of God in my mind as opposed to the oneness or the all that there is? Each person has a unique dharma. That means a unique route through. Right? So you take what you're given, which is that feeling that I want a form, and you find a form that touches your heart. It might be Christ. It might be the mother. It might be your mother. It could be your pet. It could be anyone that touches your heart, any form. It could be the man with the long beard that's in the Old Testament. I mean, it can be whichever one is useful to you. You work with that, and you start with a dualistic relationship, lover-beloved. You're singing to Ram. You're singing to Krishna. You're talking to God. Whatever you're doing in a dialogue. And then as the dialogue gets more and more and more intimate, it gets to the point where the two of you are sort of just hanging out together. And then it even gets closer, and then you begin to have moments where the merging occurs, where you move into the oneness of all things, and you move through the form of it into the formless. So it's a path through form into formless. Am I dealing with your question? Yeah. Questions? Yep. Yeah.
How do you get rid of the image of God? And go into the
How do you get rid of the image of God?
Mental image of oneness.
Yeah. How do you get rid of the old father figure with the beard? The image of God. I think that when you ask the question that way, then I would say you go into a meditative practice that treats all content, it treats the mechanics of mind rather than the content of mind. Like the statement, try not thinking about rhinoceros, okay? Now, don't think about rhinoceros, okay? Be careful, don't think about rhinoceros. And it's really hard not to think about a rhinoceros at that moment. It's the same thing. You don't try not to think about the old man with the beard. What you do is you go do something entirely different, which is like follow your breath. We're going to be doing meditations later where you concentrate and you bring your awareness to your breath. And every time your mind goes, whether it goes to old men and beards or to what you're going to eat for supper or wherever it goes, to a pain in your knee, you don't get focused on the content of the thought, just the fact that a thought took your awareness away from your breath, and you go back to your breath. So at that point, you're working then with the mechanics of mind rather than the content of mind. Because the minute you try not to think about something, you invest it with reality, and you'll keep thinking about it, and you won't get rid of it that way. So when we do that practice, you'll see how that works a little better. But do you understand what I'm saying to you? Question.
Do you think that God helps in the process of helping you change something you don't feel you're capable of changing? If you have a fear of doing something and you've tried to change it and you can't, and then you have to just let go to it, that something will come out of that?
Well, you're asking a lot of complex ways of saying different. There are a lot of subtleties in the what you're saying. The first thing you're saying is, does God help when you want to change something? Then you said, you're trying to change something and you can't, so you surrender. And then something else happens, right? That's a different thing than the first thing you asked, all right? There is a way of things. There is a harmony or law or unfolding of things. And what part of our work is to quiet down enough to hear how it all is. And part of how it all is that we try to change it and it works. And part of how it all is that we try to change it and it doesn't work. And the surrender part is you surrender into the way it is. You surrender into the unfolding of the law. You say, not my, but thy will, O Lord, for example. That would be one way of surrendering. At that point, you hear the way of things. Now, the way of things may include your fighting to change yourself, and it may not. You don't know till you listen. You listen. So you could say that within God, everything is clear. The wisdom of understanding why it all is the way it is and how it's all unfolding. Your job is to find the place in you that is that wisdom and act from within that so that that wisdom infuses all your actions with a harmony giving way of being at things. Like there are things that you try to change that aren't to be changed. And you'll try and try and it won't work. And there are other things you try and try and it does work. And there's a place you can find in yourself from which you can hear the whole thing. I listen to hear how I come out instead of making me do something. My will is not as interesting to me as hearing the will of things. So I don't know how it's supposed to come out. If you noticed in this morning when we talked about earlier, when we talked about the ways people awakened, many of them were negative things. And if you had left them to their druthers, they would have avoided those things. But they didn't avoid them, and that happened, and they did awaken, and it made a difference in their whole subsequent life. So it leaves us in an interesting position where we are doing the best we can, but we may not be all wise as to what would be the best thing at the moment. And we have to listen. So I would say that yes, God is always helping in the sense, but not helping the way you think you want it necessarily. All right? So what you're saying to God in the dualistic framework is, God, I want it my way. And God's saying, well, that's interesting. See? Can you hear the issue? Yeah. Questions? Yes.
Can you speak to us of the dark night of the soul type experience where you've been immersed in the feeling of being one with God and then it's all stripped away?
Yeah. There is a stage that St. John of the Cross refers to as the dark night of the soul. And it's after you've tasted the unity that lies behind the diversity and you've tasted the beauty and the joy and the... Then you sometimes know how to keep getting back there, and then you get to the point where everything you do to get back doesn't work. and you can't find it again, and you feel you've fallen out of grace, you feel you've lost it, you feel it's, you're feeling impoverished, you feel like you're in a hell realm. That itself is process. That is something that you were pushing away in order to get high. And it's just coming along, and until you can open to it and say, okay, here I am, I'm never going to taste God again. I blew it. Too bad. Ah, so. Till you can get into the ah, so state about that. Then right in the middle of that is the next moment. But what you're holding on to is a memory of what the state was, and that memory is a thought form that's getting in the way of this moment where it's all, where the whole thing is again. Can you hear that one? And that's part of what creates the dark night, is the holding on to the memory of the previous experience. Until you're just throwing it all in, and you don't know, is the moment with God going to come as a depression or as an elation, as a high? You keep developing these models. Well, last time it felt like this.
Yeah. Does the unitive state come back eventually?
Does it come back? It never went anywhere. The unitive state never went anywhere. But there are places. I mean, you see people that got very phony holy in the 60s and early 70s, and they wore white and they smiled a lot and they had flowers, and then you see them 10 years later pull up in their BMW to the bar and have a beer, and they're out, you know, skydiving, and it's just getting what they can, and you say, gee, what happened to that person? What happened is just another process, another state. They're going out of phony holy into, they're going the other way, and then they get phony material. And they're collecting all this stuff. They don't quite know why, but they want more of it, and because they feel like it's not enough. And then that's another stage in the process. And then out of that one comes still another stage. And you begin to, when you stand back far enough, you just see people in process. You don't see people falling off the path. Ooh, I fell off the path. Is it fun? You know, it's terrible. Ooh, scary. See, there's a way in which we infuse the spiritual journey with such melodrama. Will you get to the end or won't you? I'll tell you, you do get to the end. As long as you're not in time about it. It might take you 10,000 births, but you will get there. So you get over rushing.
A friend of ours wrote a poem, and one of the lines in the poem is, will I ever forget that I never remember you? Will I ever forget that I never remember you?
It's interesting once you have awakened, the going back to sleep isn't the same kind of sleep you had when you were in your deep sleep before. It's a different kind of sleep. It's more of a dreamlike sleep. It's a little different. Once you're hooked, forget it. It's just a process of how long it takes to reel in the line. You know, I mean, you just stop counting. You know, will it be tomorrow? Am I going to get enlightened this life? No. See, now you can relax. It's much easier now. Questions, yes.
I have a personal question. I'm curious how you reconcile the path that you're on now with your earlier upbringing in Judaism.
How do I reconcile the path I'm on now with my upbringing in Judaism? I had an occasion to explore that question very deeply this year. I spent several months preparing for a lecture on spirituality and Judaism that I gave at the University of Judaism in Los Angeles in Beverly Hills. And it was fascinating to me. It was attempting to do just what you're saying, reconcile. And I saw an interesting thing in that when I was growing up, I grew up in a family that was doing its best to become part of the economic social structure of the society. and was very focused on the social and political aspects of Judaism. And as a result of that, what I missed in my education was a direct spiritual experience. That the temple, the conservative temple, gave me sentimentality and it gave me an identity, but it didn't give me a direct religious experience. So when I then took drugs in the 60s and had an experience which I described as ineffable at first, indescribable, I then looked around for metaphors to try to understand what had happened to me. Had I had an emotional identity with my Judaism in the real open sense to the spirituality of it, like to the Kabbalah or the Zohar, things like, you know, the Book of Brilliance or Beauty, I would have found in that the metaphors I needed. But I didn't have that emotional connection. And what happened was Aldous Huxley came along and handed us the Tibetan Book of the Dead. And there was a metaphor to describe the indescribable for me. It was just another metaphor. And so I went off on a whole Eastern trip, if you will, to try to deal with the way the conceptual mind deals with that which is beyond concept, which is God, which is no name. It's G-D, it has no name. And so now, then as I got rooted in the whole spiritual dimension of life, then as I come back and read Rabbi Nachman or read, you know, Buber or read a lot of the Chassids, I find this is my mishpacha, this is my family, these people I know, this is a familiar thing, and then I see the beauty of that path. It doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be my path. I see, because now I see all paths as my path. I don't see it as a path. I see that I have to honor what it is that my karma is, that my lineage is Jewish in the sense of my body and my parents and so on. But in terms of spirituality, I now see the universality of religion. So I wouldn't say that I'm any more Hindu than Christian, than Jewish, than Sufi, than Taoist or anything. I mean, I see the richness in all of them. They're all metaphors. That's what they are. They're all metaphors. Is that dealing with your question? Yeah.
You think that suffering can be like the path to wisdom?
Can suffering be the path to wisdom? There is a statement. The first thing in that path is you must give up suffering. If you see that it's giveable, upable, then it's a path. Suffering is what suffering is showing you in the metaphysical sense. What suffering is showing you is where your mind is clinging to something. The Buddha had four noble truths that are very useful. First one is, there is suffering. There's a lot of suffering. Births, death, sickness, old age, not getting what you want, getting what you don't want. He said even getting what you want has suffering in it because you're going to lose it because it's in time. Okay, so it's all, there's lots of suffering everywhere. And you can see, you scratch the surface. If you go through this room, you scratch the surface, everybody's got suffering. Okay. Now, the next noble truth is interesting. He says, the cause of the suffering is the clinging of the mind. Like, you're growing old. You got a model of yourself as young, you're going to suffer. If you let go of the model, no suffering. Everything is changing. If you hold to a model of it being fixed, you will suffer. If your mind doesn't have fixed models, it'll just keep changing. You had a child, the child dies. Your model of you having that child as a living relationship and the present condition of no child is suffering. Letting go, new moment. Ah, so here we are. So once you see that the cause of suffering, not the cause of pain, but the cause of suffering about pain, like you take pain, you've got cancer and you've got pain. You see people that have the same kind of cancerous condition and the same stimulus condition, and they are having pain and they're not suffering. And you see others that are suffering immensely. And you see that it's the way the mind deals with the pain. It's not the pain itself. Pain is a strong stimulus, and it's how the mind deals with it. So that once you understand what I'm saying, and you start to see what suffering is showing you, because his third noble truth is, you let go of the clinging of the mind and you end the suffering. Once you see that sequence, then suffering is a path to enlightenment, because what it's showing you is where the mind is clinging, and it leads you to extricate your mind, to release the mind's clinging, to just be with what is. I mean, I spend a lot of time in India. In India, people are very poor. Many people are very poor. They are so far below the poverty level in this country. I mean, they're really poor. But you know, a lot of them don't know it. So they're not busy being poor. You know, they just get up and they get something to eat if they can get it, and if they don't, they don't get something to eat. And somehow you're with them and you feel that they're suffering less, a lot of them, than a lot of people here who are living below the poverty level or above the poverty level even. I mean, you begin to see the way in which suffering is not directly related to the phenomena themselves. And that's when suffering can become grace. You can use suffering to get free because it shows you where you're stuck. Then it's useful. Otherwise, it stinks. Otherwise, suffering's a real drag. And the interesting thing about suffering is to see that you might understand that it's grace, and you work with your own suffering to get free of it through using it to see where you're stuck and get on with it. But that doesn't mean you lay that trip on someone else. Someone else is suffering and you say, it's grace. See? See, you can't do that because each one says, no, my suffering is real. And what you find is you're dealing in yourself with that paradox that you understand at some level that suffering is grace, and still your human heart demands you do everything you can to relieve another person's suffering. And that's an incredible paradox.
This concludes Tape 2 of Spiritual Perspectives and Practices for Daily Life with Ram Dass. Our program continues with Tape 3.